Hey folks, how are you? Weingard here. Today we have a very, very special guest to talk about trauma. So why don't you introduce yourself so folks know who you are?
Sure. So, I'm a trauma surgeon. I work here at LA County. I've been here for, I guess 7 years or so. And I'm originally from Canada, but now I hang out here in Los Angeles. So,
Canadian, trauma surgeon, really nice guy. The only person that could be is Kenji Inaba. And you are one of the most prolific trauma surgeons out there. It seems like you have at least one article in the Journal of Trauma every single month.
Yeah, I don't know about that, but we do try. I spend about 50% or so of my time doing research. I have a lab. We do some, animal-based hemostatics research, as well as clinical studies. And we do some retrospective studies, some prospective studies. So we pretty much do the full range of stuff. So
fantastic. And that brings us to the topic of our conversation today, which is hemostatic resuscitation and massive transfusion.
Right.
So, one question I did not have on the sheet, but I wanted to start with is, what are you folks using to initiate massive transfusion? What's your criteria?
That's a good question. Although it kind of varies, because as you know, in the literature, we really don't have very good sort of starting criteria for predicting what is the patient that's going to end up requiring a massive transfusion. So, as a result, I think all of us practically are kind of stuck when it comes to deciding who is going to ultimately end up needing a massive transfusion, because those are the patients ultimately who we should get going early on it. So, what we've really resorted to here at LA County is starting off with blood, and that can be uncross-matched blood or type-specific blood or fully cross-matched blood. And when they hit a threshold of 6 units, that's when we sort of enact our massive transfusion protocol. And we kind of chose that 6 units because, when you look at the literature, all the stuff that's out there, both the military studies as well as civilian studies, they all looked at patients that required 10 units in 24 hours or 10 units in 12 hours. And so all the sort of data that supports the use of plasma aggressively is in that patient load. So we figure by the time we start at 6 units, and the plasma actually makes its way into the ER or ultimately into the operating room or the ICU, they'll have hit that 10-unit threshold, and, they'll be the sort of patients that we want to be very aggressive in. There are some data, as you know, that shows that if we're too aggressive with the plasma and use it too early in patients that don't end up requiring a massive transfusion, that there may be some harm. So as a result, practically, we're using 6 units as that sort of cutoff.
Now, I have to imagine there's a patient group that comes in that's so obviously going to require massive transfusion that you might start right at the door. That guy,
exactly.
60 over 40, penetrating trauma.
So
it really
has that patient load, and there's also the patient load that comes in anticoagulated already for whatever reason. So absolutely, there's going to be, those patients that you hit the operating room, you immediately go upstairs, you open, there's a bunch of blood in there, and you start your uncross-matched blood transfusions. Those guys will just call down to the blood bank because it gives them a good heads up that we're going to be needing plasma. So
now, the military would tell us that we should be using 1-to-1 or even 1-to-1-to-1. Has that translated to the civilian data for you, Ken?
Yeah,
are you starting right up front?
Yeah, I think so. I think that we all agree that there are definitely flaws in these studies. There's no question, I think we were talking about survival bias the other day, and this is something that Snyder brought up. I think it's a real issue. All these studies are retrospective, and we're not going to get around that as well. But with that said, and we know that the corrections that they use for the survival bias are, even the studies coming out of our institution, they're very crude corrections for that. So there are flaws, there's no question. And yet, it really is the best available data that's out there to help guide what we should be doing. And so, yeah, I would say that in civilian centers, certainly in our center and most of the big centers in this country, I think we've kind of swung towards using plasma more aggressively and shooting for a one-to-one. I think the other thing to note that's kind of interesting is when you look at these retrospective studies, you know, especially the civilian studies, in many of them, because of the time span that they were done over, there weren't a lot of patients getting one-to-one. So that's a bias also. And, you know, if you look at the one that came from our institution as an example, the sort of highest ratio group wasn't even one-to-one. It was actually 1-to-2 because there just weren't sufficient patients getting one-to-one because all these studies preceded, you know, this era of transfusion. So we don't even know if 1-to-1 is the real gold standard that we should be shooting for. Maybe it's 1-to-2. So, sure. So there's that issue. But yeah, I think with the data that's out there, I think that most centers would be doing this.
Now, what are you using as your actual trigger to give each set of packed cells and FFP? Are you using a blood pressure goal and just transfusing to a certain BP? Are you using labs? What makes you, or what are you asking your anesthesia colleagues to be the trigger to give more one-to-one blood and FFP?
Yeah, you know, that is also like it's a great practical question because the reality is like relying on labs is really tough in this patient load. I think that we're getting better with point of care data, but it still is not great. So, you know, we just brought iStats into the OR, for example, and we've been using it in the lab for a long time. And the INR cartridge is relatively finicky. So, you know, as an example, these point of care tests really aren't great. And they, you know, and they take time. Relying on the lab takes a lot of time. So as a result, I would agree with you. Practically, the termination part of a mass transfusion protocol in our hands almost always happens in the operating room or early on in the ICU. And so we kind of go by two things. I want to make sure that the actual surgical bleeding itself has stopped and the medical sort of bleeding visually has stopped and that they're relatively hemodynamically more normal. So you're right. I think rather than rely on labs exclusively, we do make sure, and I think it's important to make sure that the sort of bleeding that we can visualize has stopped, and hemodynamics plays a big role. So
now let's make the more controversial stuff. Let's bring that into the mix. Platelets. In the military, they're using a lot of whole blood. It's fresh platelets. We're in the civilian world using old platelets, and we're not necessarily using type-specific platelets. I know you've done work on this. What do you think, Kenji?
Yeah, you know, I think platelets is definitely an issue, and I think the age of platelets is also a very important issue as well because they're just such fragile things. And so, yes. Overall, to put it into perspective, I think that when you look at the impact of platelets and of plasma on these patients that require a massive transfusion, the role of factors and plasma is probably more important. I think that the data from before that said platelets were the first thing that were diluted out and very important, you know, a lot of that was based on whole blood transfusion research or stored whole blood that was very platelet deficient. So in this era of component transfusion, I think that factors probably outweigh platelets. But with that said, though, we have, at our hospital anyways, we have very easy access to platelets. They're, you know, because they're stored at room temperature, they can come up very quickly. So we would use platelets for anyone that comes in with a good history of asthma or Plavix use, right, and bleeding. Or when we hit that first 10 units, we're using apheresis platelets exclusively. So when that first 10 units of blood go in, with that next load of plasma that comes up as part of the massive transfusion protocol, 1 unit or 2 units of apheresis platelets will come up for every subsequent 10 units. So we're shooting for somewhere between a 1-to-8 or 1-to-10 ratio of apheresis platelets to blood.
And are you using type-specific platelets?
Yes, we are. And as young as possible. So, you know, with that last look at our inventory, I think age is probably important. So we've begun the whole QI process for looking at the age of our platelets and how we can impact that to get the youngest platelets to our patients as possible.
Makes sense. Now, a lot of our European and Canadian colleagues have moved to concentrate massive transfusion protocols. They're using PCCs, fibrinogen right. concentrates. What do you think about that? Is that the future?
Yeah, no, I think that's a great question. Yeah, every time we meet up with our European colleagues, it's definitely one of the things that we talk about the most. I think the data is increasing from there, but you know, the vast majority of the literature that's coming out that is US-based, there's just no factoring in of PCCs or any fibrinogen concentrated materials at this time. So I would say that the evidence is unclear. There are a lot of places that are gaining more experience with these products. They're virtually all in Europe. For example, here at LA County, we have no access to any of these PCCs at all. So personally, I have no experience with them. In the future, I think there definitely is a role. It's something that needs to be looked at, and it makes sense. So we'll have to see what happens over the next couple of years, I think.
Sure. Another emerging diagnostic test that's being used in some trauma centers in the U.S. at this point is the TEG or ROTEM, the thromboelastography tests. And that actually gives a more precise estimate of really why the patient is continuing their bleeding. Have you had experience with that, Kench?
Yeah, you know, just over the last year or so, we have predominantly with TEG. There are a couple places here in North America using ROTEM, such as Sunnybrook, for example. Sandra Rizzoli up there is using it a lot, exclusively, in fact, right now. And in Europe, it's used as the predominant test. But here in North America, virtually everyone's using TEG. We started, our first two papers using TEG and our experience with TEG are in the submission process right now, and they're being looked at. So very slowly, we're getting some experience with it. There's a lot of pluses because it's super fast. It's, you know, point of care. It's right there. Our ED samples are immediately spun right now for all our highest activation patients, and we're looking at the sort of data that's coming from it. But I would say globally, there are very few places in general here in the U.S. that are using it practically to help guide transfusion. I do think, though, that that's going to change. You know, this PROPER trial that's coming up, we're fully into the IRB process now at our site, and the other 11 sites are the same. Every one of the study centers for this upcoming trial will have at least one, if not two, TEGs you know, on site for every single one of the patients that's enrolled. We're going to have two going, and that's going to provide a huge wealth of information, multi-center, prospective, clean data on the admission and subsequent TEG values and how that can help guide our transfusion. So I think that there's definitely a future for it, hopefully over the next 2 or 3 years as this study runs, more information on how we can practically use it to help guide our decision-making will come up.
Well, let's talk TXA, tranexamic acid.
Sure.
When are you giving it?
Okay. It's a great question. You know, there are so many flaws with that CRASH-T study. There's no question. You know, the sites that were used, the entry criteria, you know, the actual net effect that was shown in that, probably because of the entry criteria that were used, the fact that, you know, half the patients didn't get any blood and treatment didn't change that at all. So we really don't know who deserves to get it. We don't know the mechanism by which it acts. Is it actually stopping bleeding? Is it not? But with that said, we are using it. It's very inexpensive. Here at LA County, the cost is $68 per gram. It's super easy to get. And the complications, at least in that study, which was actually really well done, technically, there's really no increase in complications. So for us, basically, if the patient comes in and they are one of those bleeding trauma patients, because we don't know exactly what criteria should be used to give this, if they're caught within the first 3 hours of, we're using admission because we don't have a clear-cut injury time, we will give it. And we're just doing a gram up front to that time, and then we may repeat it one more time after that. I think, you know, just talking about TEG, that may be one way that we can help guide who requires it, because one of the bits of data that can come from the TEG is your fibrinolysis sort of status. So, you know, if you have a patient that comes in and they are demonstrating clear-cut hyperfibrinolysis and they're chewing that up, those are the patients that may require and truly benefit from the use of TXA. So right now, you know, I think the summary is that you know, we really don't know who is the best person to give it to. Maybe it's something that will be TEG defined. It's hard to know, but practically right now, what our group is doing, based on the CRASH-2 data as well as the MATTERS data, anyone that comes in and they're one of those bleeding patients, certainly one that's going down the massive transfusion sort of algorithm, if we catch them within 3 hours, they get a gram bolus up front.
Makes sense. And you're deferring the infusion or that second dose till after they get out of the OR?
Yeah, we are. You know, I think that practically speaking, yes. And in fact, the truth is, if we do give it a second time, it almost always happens in the ICU sort of setting. And we try to give it as an infusion, as was done in the CRASH-2 trial. But, you know, sometimes it does get given as a bolus. So, many times it's just deferred, to tell the truth. So, if anything, the most consistent dose is that first dose, 1 gram up front.
I agree totally. Last question. There was an AAST paper showing that since a lot of our trauma patients are recidivists, these O-negative males who receive O-positive blood might actually have problems, and they're questioning whether we should be giving Rogam. What do you think about that,
Kenji? Yeah, no, that it was an interesting abstract, interesting presentation. I totally agree. There may be something to it. But practically, for now, we're not. So we're not even taking note of that. So in the male patient population, there's really no. We're not discriminating at all based on their RH status. So, but you know, I mean, these are the important papers that are making us think, because we are transfusing more and more our injured patients as they come in for a variety of different indications, and these are the things that may make, you know, small but important differences. So we'll definitely keep an eye on that sort of stuff. But practically speaking, right now, we're not taking note of that or making any changes based on that. So,
are there any parting words you'd like to give to your emergency medicine and critical care colleagues? Anything you think could be done differently or you just really want to get out there?
No, you know, I would say that I think it is a super important thing for emergency medicine, this whole transfusion thing, because often these decisions start early down in the emergency department, and so I think it's a very important thing for emergency medicine physicians to stay up with. And the good thing is, I don't know if it's just at our center, but our ER docs are awesome at this. So they know a lot about blood, a lot about blood transfusions. And, you know, we'll be up in the operating room working on whatever case, you know, on a Saturday night. We'll come downstairs for a patient that has clearly met, and everything's been started and been started perfectly. So I think that, A, it is a very important concept. And it's something that's evolving. And B, I think that it's well understood in the emergency medicine world. So. And you know, the only other thing that I would say is that, you know, all of this data that we're working off of right now at this time is retrospective. All of it is. So I think we are all looking forward to kind of seeing what this proper trial brings us, because this will be the first chance to get really clean, randomized, prospective data looking at transfusion practices. And so this will hopefully give us more information on what we should be giving, you know, who deserves it, when we should be initiating it, what sort of diagnostics should we be doing, TEG, do we follow INRs, what's our target, should we be trying to shoot for a certain hemoglobin, or, you know, there's so many questions that need to be answered. And so I'm hoping that this upcoming trial will help answer some of these questions. So.
Well, you know, something you just said makes me want to make one last question, which is, from everyone I've spoken to, Kenji, you folks have the best relationship probably in the country between emergency medicine and trauma surge. How did that happen?
Right. You know, I don't know if it's just a personality thing or, I'm not too sure, but I'll tell you that we are really fortunate in that we do. It is so nice for us to get called. You go downstairs and you know things are being done like perfectly. Maybe it's because of the skill level and the knowledge base of our ER docs, their personalities. It's all those things that come together. we try to do a lot of stuff together. So we have combined teaching. We do these combined rounds. There's a lot of things like that. And I think historically, it's just been like that. Our emergency department is really good. They're very good clinicians, and they're just great people. And so I think that combination just seems to work well here at LA County. And I would agree with you. It's a definite bonus of the job here. No question. No question at all. So I couldn't hope for a better ER group to have down there. They're just great guys. And so, you know, when you get called, and it's a pleasure to go down and you can take care of the patient and then hang out afterwards, there's really nothing better than that. So, yeah, definitely a good group of guys. So,
well, thank you so much for coming on the show. That was Kenji Inaba, Master Trauma Surgeon.
No problem at all. It was good talking to you, Scott, and we'll see you at the next meeting, I guess.
So. All right. Very good. Now, if you're a resident and you don't want to go do a trauma rotation at USC LA County right now, I have failed during this podcast. That was Kenji Inaba. I just love that guy to death. Brilliant, nice, humble, just the best kind of person. All right, so that was another MCRIT podcast. We have so much good stuff coming up in the coming weeks. I can't even fit in all of the podcasts and interviews I want to get on. And we have to get another live show. I'm just having a really good time these days. If you want CME, there's CME available. Come on over to mcrit.org and click on the link and you'll figure out how to get it. Why listen to this stuff and not get CME if you're an attending? I think that's all I have for now. Scott Weingart, MCRIT Podcast, saying bye-bye.